America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a live call-in show today, and our topic is How Capitalism Saved America with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo. Welcome, Tom.
Hello there.
I'm glad you could be with us today.
I'm pleased to be here.
Good. So next I would like to welcome our special commentator for us today, Mr. Drew Helm. Hello, Drew.
Hello.
Good. So let me also say hello to some of our regular listeners who we've had recent interactions with. I want to say hello to Oscar from Southern California and Leo from Boston and Hank from Chicago. I greatly appreciate all of your participation and how, in your own ways, you're standing up for freedom. So to introduce the show, first let me say again that this is a live call-in show, so please be ready to call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Let me repeat that for you. That's 1-800-313-9443. I mentioned that our special commentator for today is Mr. Drew Helm. Now, Drew is a student at the University of Iowa, but he has also spent 6 years in the U.S. military and is widely read in Austrian economics and history, and is a 2010 graduate of Mises University. This show was basically Drew's idea, and he did much of the heavy lifting in preparing for this show. So let's get started. Now, again, our topic today is How Capitalism Saved America, and it's based on the excellent book by Dr. DiLorenzo. Tom is a professor of economics at Loyola University in Maryland and is a preeminent economic historian, and has written several other books, including The Real Lincoln, Hamilton's Curse, and today's topic, How Capitalism Saved America. So go ahead, Drew. I'm giving the microphone over to you.
Hello. Well, I just wanted to start out here near the beginning of American history with the Pilgrims. Conventional history teaches that the Pilgrims had tough times when they first arrived in Massachusetts. As you pointed out in your book, Tom, William Bradford, governor of Plymouth Colony, noted that when their crops failed, some settlers sold themselves into slavery with the local Indian tribes so they could eat. And one man gathering shellfish was so weak from malnourishment that he got stuck in the mud and died. So what was the primary cause for all these people becoming so destitute, and how was the problem fixed?
Well, basically, they adopted agricultural socialism as their system originally, where they all owed some money to the Mayflower Company, for example, for bringing them to America. And so they would farm the land, and everything would go into a common pool. And then once the Mayflower Company was paid, everyone would split equally whatever was left. And that's, essentially sort of socialist agriculture. That's why that's how the Russians turned the breadbasket of Europe, the Ukraine, into massive starvation in the early 20th century. And that's how every socialist country around the world that has practiced collectivized agriculture has ruined their agriculture. And fortunately for the American Pilgrims, they figured out what the problem was. And so they changed the system, and they gave each family their own individual plot, and they created incentives. And so the reason I write about that in my book is that, you cannot have capitalism without private property, and I think it's a nice, interesting little example of how one of the primary features of capitalism, private property, literally saved the Pilgrims from starvation.
Was there any debate about this, Tom? I mean, when they were already starving and Governor Bradford decided to allocate to them different land that they were then responsible to till. We're going to run into our break here, unfortunately, so we're going to have to wait until after the break for you to answer this question.
Okay.
So I apologize in advance on that, but please stay with us, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and we're talking with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo on How Capitalism Saved America. So we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. And just before the break, we were asking Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo question we didn't give him time to answer. Go ahead, Drew. Why don't you go ahead and restate that question?
Well, we were just kind of wondering, was there any debate about the privatization of land going from the collectivized system to the privatization of land? Was there any debate about that, or how did that come about? What was the effect
of
that?
I think these people were starving to death, and William Bradford's wife committed suicide by jumping off the Mayflower because she was so depressed over all the death around her. So I think when Bradford and others came around and said, we think we have the problem figured out, I don't think there was any big debate, although originally, I think the reason why they set it up originally, such as socialized agriculture, was they were probably influenced by Plato, the Greek philosopher Plato, and his advocacy of collective ownership of land, and that's where the idea originally came from. But I don't think there was much real debate. Bradford went in there and they changed things around. They established private property rights, and then and that put an end to the starvation. And the rest is history. The colonists thrived after that. New England especially became, world-renowned for its fishing industry, its whaling industry, and small manufacturers, and the southern colonies. They also thrived and became worldwide exporters of agricultural products in just a few years.
So this is Michael again, Tom. You know, it's pretty apparent that collectivism and socialism has always led to people becoming impoverished and even dying because they think they can just live off the efforts of other people. I know this is called the free rider problem, where some people seek a free ride from more productive people, and this was noticed by Bradford during the 1600s, but it's also been mentioned many times by current writers and commentators, including Ludwig von Mises and one of our frequent Radio Free Market guests, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, in our discussions about Soviet Russia. Why does socialism / communism lead to free riding?
It's just the nature of the institution. On the example we're looking at, if you tell everybody that the fruits of everyone's labor will be split equally, then you're going to encourage a lot of people to think, why should I work hard because I can't guarantee that the man next to me will work just as hard, and I'll be supporting him and his family by my labors, and that's not fair, so I'm not going to do it. And you might get your way around that in small groups. We see it all the time, neighborhood associations and that sort of thing, but not in entire societies. So just by definition, if you get rid of private property rights, you create that problem of free riding that socialism creates everywhere and however it's practiced. Here in the United States, we still have a government ownership of about 60% of all the land west of the Mississippi. And so when people don't own the land, you have ranchers overgrazing on government land, and you have forestry companies who lease land, since it's not their own property. They tend to be more abusive with clear cutting and these other methods that are very unfriendly to the environment, primarily because it's not their land. It's not their asset. If it was their own asset, they would take much better care of it, just like people take better care of their private homes as opposed to rental property or certainly public housing.
So, Drew, go ahead with the next question.
Yeah, so, well, you kind of touched on this, but so as the early colonists recognized the need for private property rights, what was the effect on the size of the new country's economy over the the next century after that?
Private property rights, it was understood, the founders, especially people like Thomas Jefferson, were students of John Locke, who wrote his treatises on government. It was all about the property. And actually, there were protections of private property built into the United States Constitution, such as the contract clause that says that the government cannot interfere with contracts, essentially, and that was a protection of property rights, very important protection of property rights. And so, and James Madison especially, the so-called father of the Constitution, especially understood the importance of protecting property rights to prosperity, and that was certainly a key. Although, the nature of government and the nature of statism, whether you call it socialism or mercantilism or something else, is to use politics to redistribute property, to take one person's property and hand it out to another person in return for that other person or other group's votes. and political support. And so you don't have to have socialism. You can have just democracy. That can be very destructive of property rights. And that's why people like James Madison wrote into the Constitution these protections of property rights. And they've been whittled away at from the very beginning, of course. But that was the original idea, that we had to prosper by protecting private property. And it worked for quite a long time in America. It's really responsible for the great economic success of the American Pilgrims.
You know, you brought the term mercantilism, Tom, and actually this is, for a lot of our listeners, a new term. But I'd like to ask if you could explain that a little bit more, because most folks, they don't really have the background in understanding how that many of the policies that were set up by the European nations were set up to create favored companies that were given favoritism by the state, and how that spilled over into America. And this kind of favoritism called mercantilism, if you could explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, that was the economic system of England and other parts of Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries. And it's one of the things that the American colonists revolted over. And it was basically a system of public policies that would benefit the politically connected businesses primarily at the expense of consumers, at the expense of everybody else generally. Protectionist tariffs is one example. The granting of a monopoly, grants of monopoly by the king in Europe or by a legislature. And it was very corrupt. And there were a number of myths that grew up around it. Adam Smith's famous book, The Wealth of Nations, that just about everybody has heard of if they haven't read it. Very few people have read it. It's a very big book. But it was actually a critique of this system called mercantilism. And one of the myths of mercantilism was that wealth was created by the accumulation of gold or other precious metals. And therefore, if the British bought something from America, for example, gold would go out of England and goods would come into England. And the mercantilist doctrine was that, well, that would be impoverishing to England because gold was leaving the country. Mm-hmm. And Adam Smith proved that, the fallacy behind that, because it's trade and exchange and production that creates wealth, not the inflow or outflow of precious metals. And so there was a whole lot of myths and superstitions built up around mercantilism to keep it going in the minds of the public. But it was basically, today we would call it crony capitalism. And there was always a group of people in America who wanted to bring this corrupt system here. Because after all, if you're in charge of that system, it means power and wealth to you. And so there has always been a battle over that between people who advocate true capitalism and free markets and people who advocate interventionism in the form of so-called mercantilism.
Okay, go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, well, you said that, I've heard you say prior to today in, like, different lectures that protectionism or mercantilism is a government doing to its own people during peacetime what enemies would do to them during wartime. Now, today, many people will say that, you know, the steel industry or the automobile industry or the agriculture industry or any number of industries need to be protected against, quote-unquote, unfair competition. But my question is, how exactly do Americans suffer when they're forced to buy American by the government?
We suffer by being forced to pay more for inferior products, as far as that's concerned. I was talking about this on another radio show just a couple days ago here in Baltimore. And the radio talk show host advertises Volvo automobiles, and he asked me a similar question. And I told him, well, look under the hood of those great Volvo automobiles, and you'll probably find hundreds of parts that come from all over the world, because in order to make these great cars, Volvo has to shop around for the best quality parts and the best prices that they can get to make these affordable to a lot of people. And if you cut off trade, you impair the ability of companies like that, or of Ford or Toyota or any other company, to produce the best products at the cheapest prices for consumers. The way I put it is, if you cut off trade and have protectionist trade policies in automobile parts, you would turn that great Volvo S80 into a Ford Pinto or a Plymouth Volare, which were, you know, really terrible cars of the 1970s. And so, yeah, and the way I explain to students is that if you think about it, what did countries do to their enemies during wartime? The first thing is always to establish a trade embargo, to block off trade, because you know that that harms their economy and will harm their ability to wage war. But protectionism is really essentially our doing to ourselves what we try to do to our enemies during wartime.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and I guess to follow up on that, so, you know, with protectionism or mercantilism, well, Americans suffer because they, you know, they're forced to pay high prices or they have to, you know, suffer inferior goods. Who benefits from these policies?
Well, of course, it's whoever is protected from competition. For example, when President Bush, one of the first things he did was to put higher tariffs on steel. And, of course, that was very harmful to the American automobile industry because they had to pay more for steel. And, of course, they passed that on in form of higher prices for their cars. But then that made the American car industry less competitive in world markets with the Japanese car makers, the German car makers, Swedish, and so forth. And so the beneficiaries are always a relatively small group of politically corrected businesses and sometimes their unions. And of course, the costs are borne by all the rest of us. In this case, it was the American industry as well as American consumers.
Great. Well, Tom, thank you. Tom, I'm going to have to break in on you now.
Okay.
And we are going to have to take a break. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo on how capitalism saved America, which is actually the title of his excellent book, which I recommend to everyone to buy and read. Tom, I wanted to ask, we were just talking about the concept of government helping various businesses via protectionist methods. Is this why large corporations support big government so they can squash competition?
Sure, it's not only large corporations. There are a lot of smaller corporations, too. I mean, we have the Small Business Administration, which is dispenses corporate welfare to relatively small businesses. And, you know, of course, since they can't give corporate welfare to every single small business, they necessarily play favors and skew competition in favor of the ones who are lucky enough to get government favors. So it's not just big business. But the genesis of this was in the late 19th and early 20th century. It was big businesses that actually advocated and lobbied for many of the government regulatory agencies that were created supposedly to protect the consumer. The very first was the Interstate Commerce Commission. It was formed in 1887. It was supposed to regulate the railroads for the benefit of the consumer. But the first head of the Interstate Commerce Commission was the president of a railroad corporation. And then, of course, what they ended up doing was establishing monopoly prices for railroads. And then when we had the Federal Trade Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, what the big corporations figured out was they were for these things because they thought that these regulatory agencies could impose onerous costs on their smaller competitors and form what economists call barriers to entry or barriers to competition. And so big business especially has always been in favor of using big government for its own benefit. And that, of course, is what the old Adam Smith, the British philosopher, criticized in his famous book, The Wealth of Nations, that was published in 1776, was the year of the American Revolution. And things haven't changed a heck of a lot since then. They're still at it, trying to use big government as a tool to thwart competition.
Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, well, just keeping on that point, you've made a distinction between two types of entrepreneurs, market entrepreneurs and political entrepreneurs. What exactly is the difference between these two?
All right, well, a market entrepreneur is somebody who makes money by producing goods and services that are of good quality and competitive prices on the marketplace. A political entrepreneur is someone who's in business who makes money by trying to influence politics in a way that laws or regulations are passed that either sends taxpayer subsidies their way, bailouts, for example, or laws or regulations that are harmful to the competition, or at least more harmful to the competition than they are to them. that gives them an advantage. And sometimes in history there have been business people who were market entrepreneurs in the early part of their career, and then they became political entrepreneurs later, so it's not a clear-cut division. But in my book, I write about how the transcontinental railroads that were built in the 19th century, there was one market entrepreneur named James J. Hill who built a transcontinental without any government subsidies, no land grants, no cash subsidies, and he outcompeted all the government-subsidized railroads that were given many, many millions of dollars worth of free land and low-interest loans from the government. And they were much more inefficient because they were controlled by politics and not by market considerations. And so that's the difference between market entrepreneurs and political entrepreneurs. Bill Gates, his big problem with the government was he was too much of a market entrepreneur for the first years of his company. That's why the government ended up suing him. And nothing much came of the lawsuit, but they harassed him for about 10 years with investigations and then filed a lawsuit. And then eventually hardly anything came of it, but it diverted his attention and his efforts for more than a decade away from producing products for his company toward dealing with politics. And then sure enough, after that happened, he established the Washington Law Office and started bribing politicians like everybody else does. And now he plays the political entrepreneur game, although he was almost purely a market entrepreneur earlier in his career.
Very fascinating, very fascinating. So, Drew, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I guess going back, back to the Industrial Revolution towards the early 1800s, most people primarily lived on farms, but due to advances in agricultural technology, it became possible for people to leave the farm and work in the city. Today, however, many socialists and other people claim that working environment in the factories was nasty, brutish, and unsafe. But how did it compare to the pre-capitalist conditions out in the farm?
Well, I think a good way to judge that is that looking at how people voluntarily left the farm and went to the factories, and the early factories were not playgrounds. By today's standards, they were dirtier and dangerous than most jobs that Americans have today. But if you see people by the thousands leaving the farms and moving the factories, you have to assume that they must have figured that it was in their own best interest to do that, and that they were improving their lives. After all, back-breaking farm labor for 12, 14, or 16 hours a day for very low pay was not a walk in the park either. And so to a lot of people, leaving that was very welcomed relief. And besides that, they got paid more. And because of all the capital investment by American entrepreneurs during the Industrial Revolution, American labor became more and more productive and better paid. And so it was a great thing for the American standard of living to
Tom, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to take another break. And so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. We'll be right back. And we're back. You're listening to Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, and our special commentator today, Mr. Drew Helm. And I want to invite our listeners that this is a call-in show. You can call us at 1-800-313-9443. That, again, is 1-800-313-9443. And before we go on with the show, I want to plug Tom DiLorenzo's new course that he's teaching online that will be starting, I think it's September the 21st. Is that correct, Tom?
Yes, September 21st. It's a
yep.
Tuesday. Yeah, we haven't determined the time yet, but it'll be in the evening after 7.
Now,
Eastern time.
Okay, folks can look this up at Mises.org. It's Mises.org under their subtitle Mises Academy. And the name of this instruction is The Political Economy of War, subheading What You're Not Supposed to Know About War. And among many things, students will be learning in this course of instruction why capitalism is the very opposite of war and is the instrument of peaceful cooperation, the economic causes of war, and why and how war is the health of the state, which always causes less freedom and prosperity to its citizens. So please go to Mises.org and read about this All right. So, Drew, I'm going to hand it back over to you.
Well, before the break, you started talking about railroads, and one of the most common complaints about capitalism and free markets is they will not build infrastructure. So before we had, you know, the Union Pacific and before we had government intervention, how did Americans get around? How did the United States always have public roads and waterways?
No, that's one of the early myths about the free rider problem. You know, it really began with Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary, who made an argument that the government needed to subsidize the building of roads and canals in his day, and quite a few other people did. But while he was making that argument, there were dozens of private companies that were attracting investors, not only from America, but from Europe as well, and they built thousands of miles of road. They were called turnpikes. A lot of them were pay roads. And so it disproved the idea that you really needed government to build roads and canals. You didn't. But what usually happens is once the private enterprise achieves something like this, government stepped in, and they tend to monopolize. You know, it's hard for any business to compete with a competitor whose capital and labor are all paid for by the taxpayers. And so the government always tends to step in on these successful enterprises and out-compete them with its unfair advantage using tax dollars. But in the first two decades of the 19th century, there were many thousands of miles of roads and turnpike and canals built with private funds. In the state of Vermont, there was a railroad. The Mormons built their own railroad, privately funded, for example. And it wasn't really necessary at all, as the free market proved, to have to use tax dollars to build infrastructure.
Well, during the 19th century, there were a lot of business interests that were trying to get the government to build more road projects. So, say for like with the Union Pacific Railroad was the first transcontinental railroad. Where was this railroad started? Why was it started there? And who were some of the major players behind it going there?
There was a big argument in politics over the propriety of using tax dollars for something like this for many years, because a lot of politicians, understandably, did not trust politicians to spend vast amounts of money like that on something like a railroad. But one of the foremost proponents was Abe Lincoln, of all people. And in some of my writings, I tell the story of how Lincoln himself invested in land in Council Bluffs, Iowa, in 1857. And he did so because his friend, Grenville Dodge, who would later become the chief engineer of the government-subsidized railroads, the Transcontinentals, told him that would be a good place for the Transcontinental Railroad to start from the Midwest. And when Lincoln became president, he signed the Pacific Railway Bill in 1862, and it gave him, the president, the right to choose where they would start building the railroad, and he chose Council Bluffs, Iowa. And so and he must have made a huge killing at that. And all the big shots in the Republican Party especially made a killing. Thaddeus Stevens, the congressman from Pennsylvania, said, "I'll vote for this if you promise to use only American steel." And, of course, he was a steel manufacturer. There was a congressman from Massachusetts named Oakes Ames who said, "I'll vote for this if you agree to use American-made shovels." And he was a shovel manufacturer. And so there was a whole dynasty of families created, very wealthy families created by the government-subsidized Transcontinental Railroad, most of which were very well connected politically and were the ones who got these big contracts. And of course, what it ended up doing is since politics determined how the roads were built, they ended up building them very, very inefficiently. According to political criteria, every member of Congress wanted a separate line down to his district or his hometown, whether it was economical or not, and that's what they did. Whereas James J. Hill, who built the private railroad, he was only interested in economic efficiency and serving the customers in the best way possible, and he did exactly that.
Yeah, you started talking about waste there. It was really interesting. I guess with the construction of the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific Railroads and all these other transcontinental railroads, can we only assume that since they were built with the full faith and credit of the United States government that they were constructed with the finest quality with using the best materials possible?
Now, if you read my book, How Capitalism Saved America, It was sort of an orgy of inefficiency, the building of the transcontinental railroads. They literally, since they were given a per-mile subsidy by the government, they literally did things such as build railroad tracks on top of 10 feet of ice in the Rocky Mountains in the wintertime. And then when the ice melted, the tracks would collapse. But that was all good. It meant they made double the money because they got to build the tracks again. And that was sort of the par for the course in the building of the Transcontinentals. They used the cheapest products because they wanted to build as fast as possible. The faster you built, the faster you collected subsidies from the government. Whereas James J. Hill, the private entrepreneur without government subsidies, he had to use the best materials and find the straightest route, the most direct route out west, because he had to persuade customers to pay him to ride on his train. And that's what he did. Rather than pandering to politicians to get government money, he had to pander to the customers, to the people along the way, the farmers along the way who would ship their grain and other things off to the West Coast.
Where did the James Hill's railroad start and end? It was called the Great Northern Railroad.
The Great Northern, yeah, he was from Minnesota, so it started up in that part of the country. And he's a Canadian by birth. His father died when he was 10 years old. He lost an eye. He worked his whole life. He supported his mother and his siblings when he was 11, 12, 13 years old. And he ended up becoming one of America's most famous entrepreneurs. And even it's said that one of the characters in Ayn Rand's famous novel, Atlas Shrugged, is modeled after James J. Hill.
So since James J. Hill was doing so well by himself, earlier you started talking about the Interstate Commerce Commission, and how exactly did the Interstate Commerce Commission and their setting of rates, how did that affect the Great Northern Railroad?
Well, the Interstate Commerce Commission, they did many things. One of the things they did was there were complaints that people who were shipping large volumes on the railroads were getting quantity discounts, which, of course, is a very common business practice. If I'm going to ship a million bushels of wheat, the railroad will give me a good rate on per bushel, just common sense for any business person. But the smaller shippers complained about that. They thought it was unfair. So the Interstate Commerce Commission said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll charge everyone the higher rate so that there's no discrimination. And so they didn't cut the rate to anybody, to the smaller shippers. They raised their rates of the people that were getting the quantity discount. So it didn't help them at all. But later on, at the turn of the 20th century, James J. Hill was actually sued, one of the very first, successful federal antitrust lawsuits was against his company attempting to break it up. I can't prove it, but I always suspected that this was just sort of an act of revenge because he made the government look so bad for so many years by out-competing their government-subsidized railroads.
Yeah, I had another question about James Hill, and that was you mentioned that he purchased the land along the way. And, you know, how did he finance the railroad without public assistance?
Investors. He had groups of investors who invested in them. After all, America was a debtor nation until about 1920. That means that foreigners invested more here than Americans invested overseas. And people from all over the world thought that the growing American economy was a good investment. And a railroad, a privately run railroad by a well-known entrepreneur who could ship goods from the Midwest all the way to California and then across the ocean, that was a good thing to get your money behind. And so he didn't have trouble attracting investors to buy land. He paid for rights of way across Indian land with livestock or money or whatever they could trade for. Whereas with the government subsidized railroads, they socialized the cost of building the railroads by calling the U.S. Army in to essentially kill all the Indians rather than trade with them whenever they ran into the Indians. And that's primarily what the Indian Wars were about. From the end of the Civil War till about the 1890.
And I'm going to use this as a shameless opportunity to plug another interview that I have with Dr. DiLorenzo that you can find in our Radio Free Market archives called Stateless But Not Lawless, which covers a lot of the myths of the old American West, where we talk about this particular topic I have a question. Moving forward, we hear in the press from virtually all the mainstream economists that government spending is necessary to end the economic downturn that we're in right now in 2010, and they like to point to the New Deal as evidence of this working. Based on your knowledge of the Great Depression, what effect did stimulus spending and public work spending projects have on the overall economy? Did they fix the problem?
Look, it was all bad. It made the Great Depression much worse. Herbert Hoover had a stimulus spending bill and where the deficit was 13% of the entire GDP, which is twice as big as what Obama's so-called stimulus is as a proportion of the economy. And, of course, that didn't work. We had the Great Depression. And then all the New Deal spending programs, Roosevelt, his administration employed over 10 million people in government make-work jobs, but the unemployment rate was still 14, 15, 17% by the end of the 1930s, whereas the normal unemployment rate at the beginning of the Great Depression was less than 3%. So it obviously didn't work. In fact, whenever government spends money, it has to take it out of the private sector one way or another, taxes, borrowing, or it prints money and creates price inflation. And so it can only harm the private sector of the economy and pump up the government sector. And the claim that the so-called Keynesian economists make, who claim that the government spending got us out of the Great Depression, is they've pretty much given up on saying Roosevelt did that, and they say, well, World War II did it. But consider this, there were about 5.5 million unemployed people in 1940 in America, and the government drafted 11 million. And so it's no surprise that unemployment disappeared in America when we drafted 11 million men and sent them off to war. But the real Great Depression didn't really end until after World War II ended, and the government budget actually was reduced from about $95 billion to $35 billion from 1945 to 1947. That's about a two-thirds reduction in absolute dollars in government spending, and that's what fueled the real recovery from the Great Depression at the end of World War II, not just the opposite. The big government supporters claim that the exact opposite is true, just like saying night is day and black is white.
Now, before we leave the Great Depression, I have another question related to the New Deal, which is often claimed as helping all Americans. But in your book, you point out how money was passed out to political allies and New Deal employees who were actually forced to support FDR. How bad was the cronyism in the New Deal, and how did they get away with it?
Well, the United States Senate did an audit of New Deal spending during the New Deal, and one of the things they found is that in many states, people were literally required to change their voter registration from Republican to Democrat if they wanted a government job. So a lot of that sort of thing went on. In some states, they were required to donate to the Democratic Party a certain percentage of their pay in return for getting the government job, and if they didn't do that, they would not get the job. And then there's been a lot of research in economics showing that the main determinants of where New Deal money was spent was how big FDR's electoral margins were in the previous election. Wherever he had slim margins, where he barely won a state, that state would generally do much better in terms of getting government money for various make-work projects, after that election as an effort to win votes. And so as a result, the poorest part of the country, the Mississippi Delta, got very little government money compared to California, in other places where Roosevelt needed the votes. After all, by the 1930s, the southern states were still very heavily Democratic because they would never, ever vote for the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party. So FDR did not need to worry much about the Deep South. It was a solid Democrat, but he had to buy votes elsewhere, and so that was the main determinant of how New Deal spending was done. And it's similar to what's going on today. Obama's stimulus, so-called, is primarily aimed at vote buying. That's why it was written into that law that the majority of the money would not be spent until this year, the election year, even though the law was passed a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, Drew, earlier, before the show started, we were talking about, you had a question related to the Obama administration and a phrase that Tom had
Yeah, well, Tom, you, last year in one of your writings on LouRockwell.com, you coined a phrase called, to describe the Obama administration, fascialism, which is kind of a combination, or I guess a portmanteau of socialism and fascism. My question is, after going through, you know, 12 years of public education, hearing about what socialism and fascism, they're seemingly opposite, how can two seemingly opposite philosophies, I guess, work together?
Well, they're not the opposite. Fascism was simply a type of socialism. All of the philosophers of fascism were socialists and Marxists first, and they just created a slightly different variant of socialism. So they're really partners, ideological partners. And what economic fascism was in Europe in the 1920s and 30s was private enterprise was allowed to exist, but it was so heavily controlled and regimented by government that it was forced to perform functions that were only the functions that were okayed or given approval of.
Tom, I'm going to have to interrupt you again. We're taking our last break. Please stay with us, everyone. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo and Mr. Drew Helm. So, Drew, go ahead with the next question.
Yes. Hi, Tom. So during the 1970s, after, you know, going to Vietnam and, you know, with the going to Vietnam and running budget deficits, the Nixon administration decided to forget all the lessons Americans had learned from government intervention in the New Deal and the elongation of the Great Depression because of it. And so the Nixon administration imposed price and wage controls, which caused massive crises in the American economy, one of which was the oil crisis. What were some of the effects of these government interventions on the economy?
Well, Nixon put price controls on everything as a re-election ploy. And then after he was re-elected in 72, he lifted them on a lot of things, but not petroleum. And so when the Arab oil embargo came, and the price of petroleum skyrocketed up because of that, we had price control and normally a price ceiling. Normally what would have happened was that the price would have gone up, and that would have created tremendous incentives to drill for more oil in America, which would have happened, and that would have caused the price to go right back down. There wouldn't have been any crisis. There wouldn't have been any shortages as long as prices can adjust up and down. And of course, I think it also coincided with the birth of the modern environmentalist movement. So there was a lot of political pressure also to prohibit drilling for oil for environmental reasons. And so it was perfectly fine with a large part of the Washington establishment, most of the Democratic Party, that American oil companies were not getting us out of this crisis because they didn't want energy. Period. That's the anti-energy industry. There was a whole industry there, and so that's what created the massive shortages. And also, so the government came in and did all sorts of foolish things. Like, if you've ever tried to park your car in one of those little parking spots that says "compact cars only," that was a result of the government policies of the 1970s. They thought that would force us all to buy smaller cars and save gasoline. The 55 mile an hour speed limit was a result of all this, and of course nothing worked. The only thing that worked that ended the energy crisis was the deregulation of the price of oil in 1980 and 81. And as soon as that happened, it was the very first thing Ronald Reagan did after he was inaugurated, is to issue an executive order making it immediate, the deregulation of the price of oil. We had one of the biggest oil production booms in the history of America the next several years. And there was talk even of a depression in Texas and Oklahoma because the price of oil had gone down so much.
So, you know, one of the best things about your book is how you discuss the never-ending war on capitalism. And given that the anti-capitalistic mentality is extremely popular among many people today, how can we break this mold among Americans when they are saturated day and night by this really very silly message in the mainstream media?
Yeah, well, education is what I do, of course. I'm writing my books and teaching and so forth, and the radio shows are a great help. Television is a great help. There are a few shows out there now that try to spread the word. John Stossel has always been very good on television for the last 15 years or so on his economic reporting and his documentaries. And that's our only hope, I think, because government so dominates the educational system, most people are brainwashed into anti-capitalism by the government schools. What else would you expect by government schools? And they tell us the false story that we're all about to be victimized by the civil society and by the free market, and we need government to protect us, but it's really government that that harms us by interfering with the free market.
Right, and with peaceful cooperation that the free market allows.
That's right.
Yeah, so, well, I want to thank you, Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo and Mr. Drew Helm, for being with us today. This has been an excellent show, and I greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Great. So this is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom.